Okay, and then I'm also going to try to do this through Zoom again.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay, so really,
have the Zoom recording's been working for you?
I have to check the last one. I haven't really looked into it, but I've gotten an email that it was recorded. I have to go ahead and check what the quality looks like, because I think ideally that'd be better. This way, it's not like my voice is recorded naturally and everybody else sounds like a computer generated voice. You know, so if I could post the one directly through Zoom, that would be ideal. So we're over here on page, let's see, I didn't add page numbers to the Chazar B'Davar Aveh, to the new version. Okay, I'll add page numbers later. So, but I just wanted to conclude this discussion of Davar HaAved with, again, a distinction between Sochar Aleihen and Matan, an internal, this is a Ha'ara to our earlier discussion, an internal distinction between the two remedies prescribed by the Gemara in Bava Metzia, the idea that you could hire new workers and impose the cost on the breaching workers in a Davar HaAved, and the idea that you can deceive the workers by promising them a better rate, tricking them into continuing the labor and then not paying them anything except for the original rate. So what I want to point out today is that there's another internal distinction in terms of the hierarchy between these primary remedies and the secondary remedies. We had seen a distinction between Sochar Aleihen and Matan earlier in the Zman, early last week, where the tour seemed to have suggested that you have an obligation to exhaust the remedy of Matan, that first you should attempt to deceive the workers into finishing the job, and it's only if you can't deceive them, then you have a right to go ahead and be Sochar Po'alim Acherim and impose the cost on the breaching workers. Now, the explanation that we offered for that is that Matan is a primary remedy. It's more consistent with the fundamental obligation of the contract. Socher Aleihen is more removed because it requires new workers to complete the job, whereas Matan is really just a fulfillment of the underlying initial obligation of the contract that the worker who you hire to do the job is going to go ahead and finish it. So what's interesting is that I came across another distinction between these two, in addition to the tour's distinction about you have a duty to exhaust one before you exhaust the other. So it goes as follows. You recall in the Gemara in Ayin Vav Amud Beis, the Gemara spoke about a poel has a right to breach, but that right doesn't apply in a Davar HaAved, right? That's a Bamed Var Mamur and B'davar She'enu Aved, but B'davar Aved has no right to back out. Then the Gemara has another Davar HaAved, which presumably brings us back to the status quo ante and says, when is it true that a poel cannot back out in a davar aved? Bisman she'ein sham poalim liskar, right? If you'd really be in a bind because you don't have other workers to finish the job for you, aval yesham poalim liskar. If there are other workers that you could hire to finish the davar aved, va'amar tsei schar me'elu, and the worker says, "Hey, I'm breaching, but hire this guy to do it in my stead." Ein lo alein el taromas. All you have is a grievance. You don't have anything more substantial than that. So the idea that there's a remedy of Socher Aleihen u'Matan, just from the Pashut sequencing of the Gemara, it seems like that remedy does not apply in a Davar HaAvud when there are Po'alim Acherim Liskor. I guess one way you could put that, and maybe this would be Yakir's way of putting it, given his comment in the last Chabura, is that when there are Po'alim Acherim Liskor, it's just not defined as a Davar HaAvud, Bechlal, because somebody else could easily finish the job for you. So that's the simple reading of the Gemara. The simple reading of the Gemara is that when there are poel amacherim, the remedies of Sochar Aleihen u'Matan don't apply, or maybe even that it's not even considered to be a Davar HaAvod. The problem is that Rashi and Ayin Vav Amud Beis says, Bamed Dvar Mamurim, interpreting this line, to Sochar Aleihen. When is it the case that you have the remedy of Sochar Aleihen available? That's only when there are no poelim to hire. So the inference that you can make from Rashi here is what? What do you think the diak is? What's the inference?
That Matan does apply.
It doesn't apply to Matan.
Yeah, very good. It sounded like we had two, we had Yair. Who's the second voice?
Yair.
Oh, it's Ben and Yair. Great.
Ben, good. It's yours. Take it away.
No, good. Good collaboration, guys. That's right.
The implication is that this exception of this, you know, mostly this story doesn't apply to mitzvah.
That's right. It sounds from Rashi that you would have, even when you're able to hire new workers to finish the job, the remedy of matan is still available to you. Right? So then on Rashi's reading, the Gemara would be distinguishing between Sochar Aleinu and Matan. So in a Davar HaAved, Hecha Sheyachol Limtso Polam Acherim Ligmar HaMalacha, you do have the remedy of Matan, even though you don't have the remedy of Sochar Aleihem. So this is not my Diak and Rashi, it's the Rush's Diak and Rashi. The Rush quotes Rashi, and he says, Bamadur Amurim, Pirish Rashi, blah, blah, blah. He says, oh, isn't it so obvious that, of course, you wouldn't be allowed to be Sochar Aleihem if you could find new workers? V'kashali pshita kiven shemotze liskar below tosefes, lama yasem osav anparos, v'yitem lahem yoser imashemotze liskar. If you could find new workers to finish the job, why should you be allowed to, why would you have a havamina that you could hire, be Sochar Aleihem at a higher cost, if you could hire workers at the same cost, same price? He says, "V'nirli the kayal matan." It must be that the real chiddush of the Gemara is to tell us that the remedy of matan no longer applies when you could be socher po'al macherim, meaning against Rashi. And you could see the Shulchan Aruch here agrees with the Rush. The Shulchan Aruch says, "Socher leino matan haga ve'im matza po'al macherim liskor ve'hita es elut tzarech liten lem kafi masha pasak ba'achrona." If you could find new workers to finish the job at a normal rate, and you nevertheless go ahead and deceive the workers and promise them a higher rate when you could have found new workers at the original rate, then you would be liable to pay the breaching workers the new higher rate that you promised to pay them, because you had no right to deceive them in this instance. Meaning the Shulchan Aruch here, you could see, it says, Tur b'shem Arush, the Tur is following the Rush, that you have no right to deceive them in a case where you could be motzei po'al macherim. And as the Pesachei Choshen points out, this is really the Rush's Shita. Aval me Rashi, according to the Rashi Shita that we just saw, mashma dinahi she'eno yachol liskar aleihem b'chiyai gavna, aval lahatosan yachol. The implication of Shita's Rashi is that even when you're able to find these new workers at the original rate, you would nevertheless be allowed to deceive them, the original workers, into continuing the job. So why would that be? Why would you be allowed to deceive them? What would be the basis for deceiving them even though you could find new workers?
That would be because we would clearly have like a better, we consider the actual workers doing the work as a better, more of a value, more of a primary remedy.
That's right.
Than having other workers do it.
Right. So I would say two things, Ben. You're saying that's excellent. One thing Ben is telling us, and is implicit in what you're saying, Ben, is that this is really to just uphold the original contract, right? And when a worker has no right to back out, you're allowed to employ deception just to convince him to do what he has to be doing anyway, right? Whereas Socher Aleihem at a higher rate is a remedy that's more removed from the primary obligations. So the moment you could hire new workers at the same rate, that deprives you of your remedy of Socher Aleihem. But to deceive them into just finishing the job that they were supposed to do, that's available to you, even though there are new workers available at the original price. So it's a really big chiddush, but it shows you how strongly the halacha takes this idea of having an obligation to finish the job. I just want to point out, somebody have a comment or? Okay, if you don't have a comment, does someone just keep yourself muted? Yeah, you're good, Ben.
I'm Yoni.
If you look, so this is really, so again, so just to recap, it's a machlokas between Rashi and the Rush. The Rush thought that you don't have the remedy of socher, of matan available in this case. Rashi thought you do. The Shulchan Aruch paskins like the Rush in holding that you don't have the remedy available. Ben, I see Gabe has a hand, I'll take it in 1 second. Ben is telling us that this is because matan is like a primary remedy just to get the worker to do what he's supposed to do anyway. And that's why the halacha allows you to deceive him. You might explain that maybe the Rush disagrees. The Rush might hold that matan itself is no more of a basic or primary remedy than Socher Aleihem is. That's one thing he could say. Or he could even concede the point to Rashi and say that matan is more of a primary remedy. But maybe this is not even, like Yakir was telling us the other day, maybe it's not considered to be a Davar HaAved when you could just hire new workers to get the job done at the original rate. So even a primary remedy is only available when this is actually defined as a davar ha'avod, right? But the moment you have other workers who could complete the job at the original contract price, this fails to constitute a davar ha'avod. So let's take Gabe's comment here. Go, Gabe. Gabe, you got it?
I lowered my hand. I was going to make that point about the
law. So. Is that Maytal expressing her disagreement? Let's say, Gabe, did we lose you? Did you have to crisis management?
She's not down for the rashing.
Yeah, she's not down for that. There she is in the background. Yeah. All right, Gabe. So, Gabe, you're going to... Okay, we'll get back to you, Gabe, if you want to follow up. I see Ben has a hand.
Yeah, I mean, I think just...
Ben, it looks like you're back in... It looks like you're back in quarantine today.
Charleston has a stay-inside order that only started today, so we needed to get out yesterday before...
Ah, perfect.
...before they changed
that. Yeah.
Get some sun. In the Broid article, he made a slight sort of jab that Nitzan is kind of a silly concept, right? Because if the workers know about the concept that it exists, you presume if they've worked a couple times, they would know about it.
Right.
Then it wouldn't really apply. So I think perhaps some way to defend it, is that is exactly this, that yes, it is kind of silly in principle, and it'd be, you must have kind of silly workers if they're going to fall for that, but at the same time, that it's still valuable for that to be a sort of ideal path.
Yeah, you're saying the ideal path is that they have an obligation to finish it, even though practically it's going to be hard to induce them by tricking them if they know the law, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You might also say that given that the alternative is Sochar Lehen, even if you know Matan is going to be Matan, you might still do it.
Right, meaning the Polim would know it's in their best interest. Right, Yair?
Sure.
Yeah. So let me, I just want to, there's a really beautiful formulation here in the Tshuva Sarash, which makes this point kemat explicitly. I see Yoni has a hand. Let's take Yoni's hand.
Yeah, I'll just say that, related to the Ben's point, is that even when it wasn't Davar Avod, we saw a sort of discussion about if the poor want to retract, can you up the ante and nonetheless still pay them the original salary? We saw a whole discussion if you actually save a certain amount of a number at that point, can you still go back to the original salary, or is it too late? What is this trickery or persuasion?
Right.
Allowed?
Right. There is a presumption, even a non-Davar Avod case, that it's difficult for the poor to back out, right? Because we could say, oh, it was like, Adaita da tefina lecha ba'achila v'shtia, right? The Baal HaBayis kind of intimated that he'll give them a better deal. It didn't necessarily suggest a better contract rate, but just some perks on the job, right? Less difficult work or something, right, Yoni?
Right, yeah. Which suggests that in general, even non-Davar Avod cases, we have halacha as a motivation to keep the workers working for the employer and not backing out.
Right, which is consistent with this idea that once there's a contract, the halacha is pretty set on seeing it through the completion of performance. Right, and Matan is very consistent with that. Yeah, that's a very good point. So the interesting thing here is there's a tshuva of the Rush in Klal Kuf Dalet Simen Beis, you have it here in front of you, where he basically makes this Rashi point very emphatically and very clearly, which is, meaning Rashi's point that even when you could find Poalim Acherim to complete the Davar HaAvod at the original contract price, that only blocks your remedy of Socher Aleihen at a higher rate. It doesn't block your remedy of Matan. Now, the interesting point here, the problem is that there's an internal stira in the Rush, because the Rush and the Tshuva here is basically running with Rashi's idea, and the Rush in his Psakim, which the Shulchan Aruch ultimately adopts, is against Rashi, right? The Shulchan Aruch and the Psakim, which the Shulchan Aruch adopts, says that Heicha Shemotzei Poalim Acherim, you can't Matan, you don't have the remedy available. Let me just read you the Tshuva of the Rush very quickly. The Rush says, Odi Lamdeinu Reuven Shekibel Mishimon Beged Lerog Chamesh Amos Bizahav. So Reuven was hired by Shimon to do this task of stitching a Beged. And then when he started working, he wanted to back out, etc., etc. And then, I guess, Shimon convinced him to stick around. V'gazam lo lahaniach melachto, mlo sheyosef lo maos, Right, Shimon basically induced him to stay by promising to give him a much better salary, a much better compensation package. So it's a classic case of matan, where you deceive the guy into finishing the job. And as the Rush points out, this clearly was a davar avod, etc., etc. You could see v'ata horenu im Shimon chayev hatosefes ki machshivo kedavar avod dekaimel on sochar leino matan lo shana pal v'lo shana kablan. The question is, could he not have to pay this higher rate because he considers this to be a davar avod, because it'd be very difficult for him to find somebody else who would finish the job. Okay. So look what the Rush says in his answer. Tshuva. Kivan de kabon lo matzi mahadar. V'yado ala tachtona im chazar bo. Af im haya motze acher haya yachal lahatoso. He says, since the guy is not allowed to back out, even if the employer could find new workers to finish the job, okay, he's still able to deceive him. Okay. V'davka l'inyan sochar aleim im basa chavil l'yado haynu davka im ena motze po'al acher. And the whole distinction about if you could find new workers to finish the job, that you don't have the remedy of socher aleihen umatan, that's only with respect to the socher aleihen part of the remedy. Aval lehatoso kedei ligmar milachto kimo shehu chayev ligomra, but just to deceive him to finish the job as he in any way is chayev to finish the job, right? It's like the primary obligation of the contract. Since really the fundamental duty of the poel or the kablon is to finish the job, so the Rush thinks, of course you could deceive him into finishing even when you're able to find other workers to do the same thing. So I think this formulation of the Rush distinguishing between Sochar Lein and Matan and telling us the reason for Matan is because the poel in any event is hu chayev legomra shari min adinin yachal lachzor, is just a very nice articulation of this principle that matan preserves the fundamental, the primary duty of the contract, which is to see performance through to its completion. And that's the basis of distinguishing between sochar lein and matan. Okay, I just want to point out, make two other comments on this, then I'll take some hands if you have questions. The Beis Yosef in Simen Shin Lamed Gimel points out that that there's a stira between the Rush in the Psukim and the Rush in the Tshuva. He says in Shin Lamed Gimel Dalu, the Beis Yosef quotes this Tshuva of the Rush. He quotes the Rush's answer, and he says Lofi zeh my demashmi perish Rashi. Right, he quotes Rashi, and he says V'rabenu kasav divrei hatshuva beinyan sheyaskim. Did I get this right? Hadatanya. Yeah, well, at least in the beginning of the Beis Yosef here, he's pointing out that Vizel lefima demashma miperish Rashi. This tshuva of the Rush, yes, this tshuva of the Rush is consistent with Rashi Shita against the Rush's own psakim. And then he points out that when the tour paskins lahalacha, the tour seems to reject Rashi's Shita, and therefore also the Rush's Shita and the Tshuva, and instead adopts the Rush's Shita and the Psukim that doesn't distinguish between Sochar Lein and Matan. Okay, so Yoni has a hand.
I guess we'll get to the Achrayim, what their potential Chilukim are between for the Rush.
Yeah.
But maybe you could suggest that, just like one obvious one would be that between Kablon versus a poel.
Yeah.
For the Rush specifically, referring to a case of a Kablon, and specifically a Kablon is one who can't leave, and therefore we're more induced to like find any way, and you can even mean mate.
Yeah, I think that's a very nice.
As opposed to a poel, where a poel has a specific ability to leave when he wants to, so we're not going to give him that right, so to speak, to trick him.
Yeah, I think that's a very nice distinction. You could definitely use that to miyashev. Yeah, you know, poel bedavar avod would be different from the case of a Kablon. And that's Abi Miyashev, the stira between the Rosh and the Pesachim and the Rosh and the Tshuva. Yeah, it's a very nice suggestion. But see, the Beis Yosef is bothered by it. He thinks it's a real stira and you can't reconcile it. And that's why the tour ultimately went with the Pesachim against the Tshuva. It's kind of interesting that you'd side with the Pesachim over, even if the Rosh himself and a Tshuva adopted Kepirish Rashi. Anybody else have hands on this? And then we'll get to the Achronim's distinction. Anybody have thoughts on this? Looks like Adam's pacing. Noam, why did you turn? You know your name is now Noam Arlo.
It's my alter ego.
Noam Arlo. Got it.
Yeah, I mean, so I have a comment that's like specific to the sugya, but like the notion that there's a primary remedy for completion of the malacha seems to go very much against Broyd's theory that halacha doesn't value contracts and enforcement of contracts.
Yeah, 100%. I think half the things we saw this semester that talk about kfiya and right, all those things are just conveniently absent from the article. We'll talk about that in a minute, actually. Guys, just give me 30 seconds. I just have to run upstairs to set up my daughter's Zoom conference for her school. Just give me 30 seconds and I'll be right back. I'm just going to pause the recording, but feel free to chat with each other for a second.
The recording has stopped.
Okay. You'll see the Achronim. The Achronim just have two interesting points here. They don't really get into the topic that we're interested in. I'll just mention these Achronim. So really, what for our purposes, this is really what I wanted to bring out here, that the idea we saw earlier in the tour where he suggested or implied that there's a distinction between the remedy of Socharlein and Matan in terms of which remedy you have to exhaust first, the hierarchy of the remedies, that's explicit in this idea of Rashi. And then again, the Tshuva Sarash, that there's a distinction between the remedies with respect to the case of Motzei Paul and Macherim Liskor. That's really what's important for our purposes. It's just L'Shem Shleimus Ha'inyan, I want to note that the Shach here doesn't like that there's a stira between the Tshuvos. He doesn't like that there's a stira between the Tshuva Sarash and the Psakim. The Shach here in Shin Lamigim Alamid says that maybe the right way to distinguish between the cases is that it's not a distinction between Sochar Alei and Umatan. So really there's no distinction between those two. The relevant distinction is rather between a case where the Poel says, hire this guy in my stead. So when the Poel says, look, I'm unavailable, but Adam could do it for me, let's say, then you don't have the remedy of Socher Alein or Matan available, okay? Because the Poel found your replacement. It's only in the case where there are Poelim available to replace him, but the Poel doesn't explicitly say Schor Me'elu. He doesn't like designate a replacement or say, go get those guys instead. In those cases, you may still have the remedy of both Socher Alein and Matan available. And so he thinks that the distinction between the Tshuva Sarash and the Rosh and the Psakim is whether the employee said Sei Schor Me'elu. So he says, V'yesh lomar davka kishapol yodea sheyesh kan acherim v'amr le balabayis harei lefanecho acherim liskar dehavale kemamid lo acher bimkomo. V'lfiza nicho had dikasav ha-Rosh b'tshuva devekablon shechozer yochalato so afim hayemota pol acherim dehasamari she'ena pol omer lo schor me'elu. Okay. Does everybody get that distinction of the Shach? I'm actually not sure if I said that correctly, because it could be that the Shach is upholding the distinction between Socher Alein Umatan. He acknowledges that distinction, actually. He's just offering an internal distinction. So he agrees, let's say, with Rashi's reading. And he's just saying that the Rush would concede to Rashi in a case where the Poel did not say Tsei Schor Me'elu. The Rush only disagrees with Rashi, meaning he only disagrees with the distinction between Socher Alein Umatan, in a case where the Poel says Tsei Schor Me'elu. In that case, you wouldn't even have the remedy of Matan. But if the Poel didn't say Tsei Schor Me'elu, then the remedy of Matan would be available. The remedy of Sochar Lein would not be. I'm not 100% sure which is the right way to read the Shach here. Anybody have thoughts on this?
I think it's the reverse. I think that he's maintaining the rush in the Pesachim as the Ikar.
Yeah.
Meaning the point is that you cannot, you know, in the case of the Gemara, which is say it's Chormeilu.
Yeah.
That, excuse me, that you'd have no remedy. How do you explain this rush in the Tshuva? That's a unique case where he doesn't, you know, point to other workers. Why the distinction is germane, it hasn't been explained yet.
My question is, in the unique case where the Poel does not point to other workers, does the Balabais have both remedies of Sochar Lein and Matan available, or only the remedy of Matan?
In the Tshuva, it looked like he had just had Matan.
Right.
So he's trying to justify the rush in the Tshuva.
Right, that's the second reading of the Shach that I was suggesting, meaning the Shach recognizes the Rashi distinction between Sochar Lein and Matan, but only in the limited case where the Poel does not say Tzei Schor Me'elu. If he says Tzei Schor Me'elu, then you don't have the remedy of Matan available. But if that's the Shach's point, then I guess he is recognizing the distinction between, which for our purposes is what we're interested in, the distinction between Sochar Lein and Matan. Yakir, do you have thoughts on this?
Not right now. Should I?
No. I'm just curious. Sounds like Ami might have thoughts. Anybody else have thoughts on this idea of the Shach? Let me just point out that the Ktzos and Shin Lamed Gimel Yud Beis, again, this is really a little beyond our discussion, is very upset with the idea that you might distinguish between a case where the Poel says Tzei Schor Me'elu and where he doesn't say Tzei Schor Me'elu. He doesn't think that's a reason to distinguish between your ability to be Matan. If there are Poelim available, then you shouldn't be allowed to... You should have duty to make recourse to those Poelim. There's no reason why the Poel should have to designate his replacement. Adam, I see you have a hand.
Yes, like, to be preemptively, I guess, discussing that point, it's interesting how this Chomeilu has sort of, is a way of the Poel continuing to fulfill his obligation.
Yeah, I like that formulation. Meaning, I think conceptually the way to understand the Shach is that in a Hanami, right, there is a primary duty to see the contract through to completion, and like the Tshuva Sarush, the Poel has an obligation to see it through, and that's why you're entitled to deceive him, right, just to uphold the performance of the primary obligation of the contract. However, this is what you're pointing out, Adam, when the Poel designates his replacement, it's as if maybe the Poel himself is fulfilling it like through his shliach in some way, right? Right, Adam?
Indeed.
Yeah, exactly.
There's also a question, but there's economic cost associated with finding someone else.
Yeah.
So by me going and finding someone for you, I've taken away that process, that you're guaranteed that their job is going to be done.
Maskim. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking something along the same lines as Adam. Like, I'm trying to figure out why Yakir's point isn't accepted by everybody, that this is no longer a case of Davar Avid when there are available workers. But I think you need to go in a direction that Adam's going in. There's, like, either an economic cost or, like, an uncertainty or an anxiety, which the Rabbi endures when he loses his workers and doesn't yet know if he can find replacements.
Right. Meaning even, like, some sort of, like, transaction costs, or even just like the fact that you have to deal with somebody else. It's always a headache to have to train a new hiree and deal with somebody else when you wanted to deal with somebody you're used to.
Yeah, it's still a little hard to explain why that counts as a dollar half. Like, it doesn't seem like he will actually incur loss if
right.
they're readily available.
Right. I agree. Those are such difficulties. Let me just point out that Ktzos and Shin Lamed Gimel Yud Beis, so again, he doesn't like the Shach's distinction between Tzei Schor Me'elu. So by the way, I think this characterization of the Ktzos within the Shach suggests that he reads the Shach as still recognizing the distinction between Sochar Lein and Matan, right? And just that Shach is making an internal distinction between within your right to be within the limited case where you're able to be Matan but not Sochar Alein, He's distinguishing between Amartsei Schar Me'elu and Lo Amartsei Schar Me'elu. He just thinks that doesn't really work out nicely with the language of the Rush. He doesn't think that's really the Rush is distinguishing between the case of Schar Me'elu and Lo Schar Me'elu. But he does point out, which is interesting, that this idea of the Ritva in the Shit Mekubetzes, I mean, we have it in our Ritva. He says, V'efshar disfir le laharash, and I think this is a way to justify the Shach, T'min adin ena kabon chozer afilu yesh polam acherim, ela imken amar lo tse schar me'elu. And I think the rationale is, as Adam pointed out, right? Then the new polam are replacements, or they're fulfilling the original guy's duty for him. And then he brings a raya from this Ritva. The Ritva says, from the fact that the Gemara uses the phrase of Tse Schor Me'elu, the Gemara's case is a case where the Poel says, hire these guys, as Yair pointed out. Midinokat Hai Lishna Mashma Sha'alehen Levarer Ulaharos De'ika Poelim Liskor. Vi'i'ika Tainu Kfir Ben Balabayas Lepoelim Bezeh Ala Poelim Lahavi Raya. The Ritva argues that you could be medayik from the language of the Gemara, that what if there's a dispute between the Balabayas and the Poelim about whether other workers are available to finish the job? So basically, let's say it's, in Yakir's words, it's machlokes whether or not this was a davar ha'avud, right? So the Ritva says you can infer from the fact that the Gemara said that the Poelim have to say Tzei Schar Me'elu, they have the burden of proof to show that other Poelim are available to finish the job. Okay? So the Ritva says this is a possibility of interpreting the Rush in the Tshuva. He says maybe the Ritva in the Chidushim is a motivation for this idea that there's some burden on the Poel to have to find a replacement. But then he says, no, he thinks the Halacha rejects this. He thinks the fact that the Shulchan Aruch makes a point of paskening like the Rush in the Psakim shows that l'halacha, we don't buy this distinction between amartzei schar me'elu and lo amartzei schar me'elu. So he's saying maybe the Shach is right as an interpretive matter within the Tshuva Sarash, but it's rejected l'halacha. And then he says maybe even the idea of the Ritva is not a good paradigm for defending the Shach's view, because, again, the Shach's view is that the Poel would have a duty to say tzei schar me'elu in order to be off the hook. The Ritva is making a much weaker claim that it's only that if there happens to be a dispute about the availability of other Poelim, the burden of proof is on the Poel. But that's a very different consideration than the Shach's consideration that in each and every case of the Poel wanting to back out, he has to find or point to his replacement. So the Ketzos acknowledges the theoretical legitimacy of the Shach's distinction. He points as a parallel to the Ritva's idea that the burden of proof is placed on the Poel. But ultimately, he thinks that A, lahalacha, the Shach's distinction is rejected, and that the Ritva's discussion is too weak to justify the stronger conclusions of the Shach. Okay? Anybody have comments on just that last? I see we have a hand from Yoni. Go for it, Yoni.
Yeah, just going back on Adam's point, and I guess what gave us earlier about like the general Shach's point, I would say that when you talked about the duty to mitigate, we were talking about the sugya of the Chazar of Baal Bayit.
Yeah.
So, like, one of the things we brought up there was that the duty to mitigate might be specifically best mitigated if the Poel finds, so to speak, an alternative to work for him explicitly, right? If you find someone else to work for you, then it's almost like you're extending that work.
Yeah.
Right, we talked about it in reverse. We talked about it with regard to the Balabai, that if the Balabai finds somewhere else to work for, then it's as if you're keeping that contract for a different employer.
Yeah,
they
that's
make
right.
the exact same argument with regard to the Poel, and say that if the Poel finds someone explicitly, like the Shach is saying, then you're really just finding someone to replace you. It's almost like your Shliach, as Adam has said.
Yeah.
But if it's, you know, if you're not actually making that statement, then it's a lot less. It's not exactly the same.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like a variation
so
on
I
Adam.
I think there's certainly... Yeah, so I think there's certainly a lot of proof, so to speak, for the Shach going forward.
Yeah. And I think the Ketos is acknowledging that. I think the Ketos is just taking issue with that. Those are more like limited proofs. It's not clear that they would justify the idea that the remedy of Matan would be available in every case that where the Poel didn't say Tzei Schar Me'elu. I think that's what the Ketosis is taking issue with. Though I think you could acknowledge your broader point that there is a conceptual and maybe even a halachic distinction in some cases between Schor Me'elu and Lo Amar Schor Me'elu. Yeah. Okay, any other comments on this sugya from the Olam? Okay, so should we discuss, let's take 10 minutes now to get our feet wet in the Broid article, and then maybe when everybody has more time over the weekend, over Shabbos, you know, there's no Chazar Sashatz to get reading in, but I guess there's more time overall to get reading in. So let's take just 5 minutes now to talk about the Broid article. Let me pull it up here on the screen. So let's take, I know Yoni, you have a lot of thoughts on the article. I think maybe we should focus specifically, Yoni, why don't you frame the broad issues for us? And then we could talk about specifics. I'm mostly interested in, I think as Yoni's going to tell us, that this article is flawed mitchil v'yad sof. I'm mostly interested in the discussion starting on page 54, where he's talking about the remedies for breach of contract. It goes page 54 through page 58, up until his partnership discussion. So it's really 4 pages. Where what he's trying to do is outline the remedies and damages for breach of contract. I think this part of the article has many errors, and I think the rest of the article also has. I remember in the beginning, Yoni, I'm just going to hold you to account. It shows that we actually learned a lot this year. Yoni, in the beginning of the year, you said that the article is really good in laying out all the distinctions and the different shitos. I think having gone through the sugya now, you realize that it's actually really bad. Right? Yoni?
Well, I think I said that the framework was flawed from the beginning, but yeah, I thought that the main part, like going through the topics, was better written, but
right.
Yeah, I'm with you now.
Now that you've gone through the set topic, you realize how problematic it is.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I kind of gave them the benefit of the doubt to like the more like specific claims.
Right.
But
right.
The framework, I always thought was very bothersome.
Yeah.
Very problematic.
See, this is my life. This is the, you know, the frustrations of reading other people's like halacha articles. All right. As and Yair, this is.
Should I study with Broid and Emery?
That's right. I won't say that on the recording. Yair, and this is meant to be a prelude also to that synopsis of Ones and force majeure and the contracts that are canceled due to Ones. We're gonna have the same issue with that discussion. So we'll get there in the next few weeks.
You can do the same exercise with Rabbi Reese's Facebook
post. All right, that's right. Okay, so Yoni, you want to walk us through some of the main issues here before we break? Let's take like 15 minutes just to outline some of the main issues.
Should I start with the framework or with the? Or with, like, the specific points?
Yeah, start with the framework, because I think the article has an agenda, right? The article is trying to argue that there's this substantive difference between common law contracts and halacha contracts, and it creates all the, you know, he has this agenda to show that the halacha is less pro-contracts or less into contracts and therefore less willing to enforce them as opposed to secular law, and then he thinks that that has to do with, like, the halacha's conception of freedom in some way. Right, so Yoni, I see Adam, you have a question before Yoni talks?
No, I just want to make sure I get in after Yoni talks about the framework.
Okay, good.
I have no comments about it.
Okay, good. So yeah, Yoni, you start off on the framework, and then we'll get Adam on the framework, and then we'll go back to Yoni on the particulars.
Yeah, so the basic framework that he posits is that the phrase that B'nai Yisrael Avadim V'lo Avadim L'Avadim, this idea specifically that refers to a Poel's ability to be Chozer in the Yadol HaLayona, he thinks that that's like a real Talmudic principle which applies throughout all of contracts, and that Halacha in general is very against binding anyone to have to work or have to commit to something, and that Halacha always can kind of give you the out. We're very weary of anything that even slightly resembles bondage.
That's right.
So he frames this, like the middle part focuses specifically on contracts, which I think is more related specifically to the issue, and you could argue how much the Poel issue is related to it. But his framework, he brings in all other sorts of dinim in Chosh and Mishpat that are not really related to it. So he'll bring in first the concept, he'll bring the first thing he quotes is the Rambam about a kinyan, which is kinyan dvarim, right? If I make a kinyan that doesn't have any specific claims, I don't make anything, I don't make it on an item, so it doesn't work. So he claims that that same principle of kinyanim not working is because of this general halachic principle that we don't desire any kinyanim from happening. We want them to be very limited in their nature. We don't want to bind you to anything.
That's a really good point, Yoni. I don't think I was sufficiently aware of that. You're making a really good point. You're saying that the article's structure is really just trying to show, the halacha is low on contracts, right? The halacha doesn't have the same robust conception of contracts that secular law has. And he cites all these things, but the things that he cites really make different points and they're grounded in different reasons. So the fact that it's difficult to create a contract in halacha in some cases is really distinct from the issue of how far we're willing to go in enforcing a contract. Is that the point you're making?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the one that became Devarim is the first example, and then he speaks for a while about Devar Shalov Al-Olam as an example. But Devar Shalov Al-Olam, one way to understand Devar Shalov Al-Olam is potentially about your inability and that we're trying to protect you for, from commitments. Maybe that's what it is. But it also could just be about your das. You can't necessarily have das about something in the future. Or it's just that the method of kinyanim don't work. And right. He consistently, throughout his framework, talks about all of these halachic dinim that are not contract-specific to make this general, larger claim. But all of those other dinim are just not relevant. And his argumentation is very flawed in how he presents that the reasoning behind these dinim is because of this unwillingness to make people avadim.
Yeah,
it's just not what majority of people argue.
Right. That's a good way of starting us off. Let me get Adam wanted to get a comment in before you take us further.
I completely agree with what Yoni has said and all those things, especially the aspect about Kinyan Nadal Shalom Ba'olam. Right, foundationally, he has not shown anything in secular law that has shown that historically there theoretically could have been a problem in secular law Nadal Shalom Ba'olam. He's not shown any proof in regards to it. Most of his issues have dealt with tenets pure monetary relationship. So he's not actually rooted in Devar Shalom Ba'olam. But I think issue with his, more general question at hand is that directly he thinks that Judaism is presenting more of a rights-based framework versus common law, which is taking more of a duties-framed type of look at how things work.
Yeah, that's a nice point, Adam. You're right. He frames this with that quote from Cover, who we read earlier in the year, as if this is all just an outgrowth of this idea that halacha is more rights-based than duty-based. And he's thinking that, you see how the halacha is so skeptical about enforcing the duties of contract, right? Or it makes it very difficult to create real duties under contract. And he thinks this ties into that larger theme. Yeah, that's also a nice point.
So it made me think of the following quote from Marx. I have a lot of fun. Read it. It's very short. Actually, it's not that short. It's a paragraph. Okay. Since the state is the form in which the individuals of a ruling class assert their common interests, in which the whole civil society of an epoch is epitomized, it follows that the state mediates in the formation of all common institutions and that the institutions receive a political form. Hence, the illusion that law is based on the will and indeed on the will divorced from material basis on free will. Similarly, justice, in its turn, reduced to the actual laws. So the application, really, I think, of the fact that contracts need to be more duties-based in common law may reflect the fact that who has the interest in writing the common law and the reflection of contracts in the ruling class, and they're always in generally in the position of power bias.
Yeah, it's that's definitely very Marxist. It's an interesting point. That kind of accepts too much of you're right. I mean, it accepts too much of his analysis as being true. You're saying, given that it's true that common law focuses more on forcing these duties, it can be explained by the people who make the law have these more landed aristocratic interests of ensuring that the people they hire do the jobs that they're supposed to do, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it just creates like a false framework from which, like, of course, they're going to be different.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. It's an interesting observation, but I definitely agree with your, I agree with this observation also, but your first observation is more like at the heart of our discussion here, that even trying to frame the halachic distinction versus the common law distinction in terms of rights versus duty, I think is going to be a little problematic. Yeah. Yoni, you want to give us 5 minutes on the substantive claims where you think they're problematic?
Sure. So even like the more narrow claims that are specifically Surat Poalim, which I think is where it should have started and ended, really, not even discussed like the larger issues. It's like very telling. Like, I'll give you one example. If you can all turn like 57, what if you have just moving across 57.
Yeah, I'll move.
So he's talking about partial performance in 57. So what happens if you, I guess Hakaf Malacha would be the case, right? You started working or you or arrived there. And then he explains it then. Then in the last paragraph on the page, he says, this last rule is rather puzzling. Uncharacteristically, the Talmud enforces a partially executory bargain and awards expectation damages. Right? And he says that this whole thing is weird because it's not like the rule. But it goes against his whole claim, the whole concept of Hatzalat Malacha, that you still get paid effectively your expectations, not only reliance damages. Right, they get it paid for the full value of the salary, maybe minus Tarkatala. That goes against his larger point of you don't have to get forced for things you haven't done yet. So that would go against, you know, Avadim Avadim Avadim. But the larger point here is clear that he thinks this case of Hakaf Malacha is the exception, but like it's probably the rule.
I agree.
A lot of Rishonim we saw, like this is the real rule, and it goes both ways, both with regard to the obligations of the employer vis-a-vis the employee, that now he has to pay for Hakaf Malacha, but also with regard to the employee himself, with regard to his obligations towards the employer. And he doesn't really discuss it. He's pretty limited on when he talks about the employee's responsibilities. But like we just read through a whole sugya of Sokar Aleha and Matan and all these different primary and secondary issues, and he doesn't really discuss any of those. And
yeah,
a lot of those points of like the employee himself being forced to stay. And that's even if he's a poel, not only a kavlan. We talked about like all these things. And Dabar Avod is like really limited in his assessments of it. Like throughout, he just overplays the poel's ability to leave without focusing on a lot of Rishonic literature that focuses on, in truth, the poel can't really leave.
Yeah, that was an excellent hakdama, Yoni. Let me just add just two general points just to flesh out what you're saying, or to re-summarize them. The slant of the article here is to show that the halacha doesn't really award any substantial damages for contract. It's never going to enforce the performance of a contract. It doesn't take contracts seriously, and so he pumps he liberally pumps the makoros of, you know, pol yachal lachzer b'chatzi ayom. He doesn't talk about any of the real exceptions. He doesn't talk about the Rishonim who say, oh, if a kinyan was done, then Pol Yochel Lachzer B'Chatzi Ayom doesn't apply. He doesn't talk about all the cases that we discussed where, you know, Pol Yochel Lachzer B'Chatzi Ayom does not apply. Right? We saw a whole slew of these kinds of cases. His discussion of Davar HaAved is very limited. His discussion of Kablan is very limited. Even when he talks about the remedies of, let's say, the Davar HaAved cases, he doesn't mention the Rishonim who talk about Kfiya as a remedy. Yoni's right. When he talks about the cases of partial performance of Aschalas Malacha, of the poel being entitled to the full salary, he says, oh, this is a weird exception. It doesn't fit into the halacha's rules. And Yoni's pointing out, Mechatesi, this is an exception. This might be just the general rule. So I want us to take Yoni, that was really, really good overview. But I think since everyone didn't have a chance to read this part as carefully as we all should have before this chabur, I think we should take the weekend. We'll spend maybe like a half hour in the beginning of the next chabur discussing this in greater detail. And, you know, look back at our summary. We spent, you know, a long time on this. We spent, you know, maybe like a few months even on all these different remedies for breach of contract and even just trying to articulate as to what a contract is. So closely examine the way he portrays things, both his meta claim, his two meta claims that the halacha doesn't really have this idea of a contract, and his claim that this is somehow related to the halacha's conception of the freedom of the worker. And then also like his more specific claims about how he conceives of damages and how he thinks the halacha's standard award for damages is based in tort and not based in ideas of contract law, right? And then his chalking up this idea of haschalas malacha to some fluke that he can't make sense of. So I want to take, you only did an excellent job here outlining the issues. I want us all to like weigh in critically on this in the beginning of the next Chabura. You know, for me, it's just these things are frustrating because this is so much, this is how, you know, so many of these English discussions of complicated halachic topics end up being discussed. You know, kind of this summary way with like a slanted agenda of distinguishing the Jewish conception from the non-Jewish conception, even when it's not really true to the Makoros here. But I see Adam has a hand.
Yeah, just I see that discussing from a purely Talmudic framework rather than from a framework of halacha.
Well, you'll see he's really, I don't think he means Talmudic versus halacha. You'll see that he's quoting, you know, the Shulchan Aruch to decide what's normative and what's not normative. So I think he is using the Shulchan Aruch really as his anchor point.
I think he uses the Shulchan Aruch to his advantage, but I think if you were to really look at the framework of the Gemara and maybe some earlier Rishonim, the discussion doesn't develop in such a nuanced way where we actually come to the case of having all of these particularities that make you realize that it's taken more seriously in practice.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea. It's kind of like I kept saying throughout this man that if you look at the Rambam, you get a much more primitive conception of the halacha's theory of contracts than if you look at the way, you know, it gets developed in the Shulchan Aruch and later poskim.
And he mainly uses all the Rambam. It's like he uses the Rambam as his main backbone to understand the Rishonim.
Yeah, does he say that this thing is limited to the Talmud's conception? Is that like his overall claim? Or
he doesn't say that, but he always says the Talmud.
Yeah, but I don't know that he's doing this historical analysis claiming that the Talmud had a different conception of halachic contracts than, say, the Shulchan Aruch and, you know, say the Haggadah.
I don't think he does. I think he just does a weak job of presenting how the halacha more broadly conceptualizes.
Yeah.
Halacha.
Yeah, that's a good point, Noah. So, Noah, I see Noah, you're back to Noah Marlowe.
We need a good Strauss Center symposium on this, right?
Right. Right. Or maybe that's exactly what we don't need to get to the bottom of things. All right, guys. Yasher Koach. So let's pick up. We're going to pick up on Tuesday with, let's say, a 20-minute discussion of the article. We'll work off Yoni's really excellent introduction. And then we'll move into the cases of force majeure and onus and canceled contracts. All right, everybody?
Sounds great.
Yasher Koach, everyone.
Thank you.
Take care.
Confirm. You will.
Freilich and Purim.
It's always Purim.
Okay. Good job, everybody. Thank you.
The recording has stopped.